Must be time to start. All of a sudden, everything got very quiet, so we'll kick this off. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Museum of Our National Heritage for the first in our spring Lowell Lecture Series. Your bat is your life, remembering the Negro Baseball League, which was produced in collaboration with the Cambridge Forum and is being recorded for later broadcast. I want to take a moment to thank both Alice Promisel, who's director and coordinator of public programs, and Jane Schwartz, Director of Public Programs, for their efforts in putting the series together. It's taken a lot of work, but we have some outstanding speakers coming up. And I did want to remind you of two other programs that their notices out front, but I just want to cover very briefly. On Sunday, March 25th at 2 o'clock, by the cut of her clothes, the role of women is reflected in how they dressed, 1830 to 1890, will feature Cheryl Peters, Director of Education at Orchard House in Concord, as she analyzes the changing role of women through their dress, which should be very interesting. And then Sunday, April 1st at 2 p.m., Golden Steps, Golden Door, Golden Dreams, The Immigrant's Quest for a New Life, with Westy Egmont, who's executive director of the International Institute of Boston and the Dreams of Freedom Museum, which has been getting some coverage in the newspaper lately, who will explore the history of the region's immigrants and the impact of the increasing diversity of today's newcomers to the Boston area. So those are two of four. We have green sheets out there, and please take them home with them, put them on your calendar. And then finally, I want to mention on Saturday, March 24th, from 10 to 11:30, as part of our Family Treasure Series, learn what your heirlooms can tell you about your family's history. Brenton Simons of the New England Historic Genealogical Society will guide you in the art of family, genealogical artifacts from New England and beyond. There's a small admission of $8 for this program, but I guarantee you, if you have things like samplers and family documents that you'd like to have looked at, I'm sure you'd be glad to do that. So please put those on your calendar. During this millennial year, the museum is celebrating its own 25th anniversary and looking back at the salient events of the past century of American life. When Jackie Robinson broke the color line to become the first Afro-American player on a white professional baseball team, he opened the doors of professional sports to countless athletes of color in the years that followed. And his achievement also closed the door on a parallel tradition in baseball, the Negro Baseball League. What was life like in American sports before racial integration? How was the league important to baseball and to the country as a whole? What finally does an institution like the Negro Baseball League say about the place of sports in American society? These questions serve as the basis for a discussion led by the Reverend Henry Bo Mason, also known as Henry Pistol Mason. The hard-throwing right-hander made his way from tiny Marshall, Missouri, to become a standout performer for the legendary Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro Leagues. Born in June 19, 1931, Mason's baseball career began in the street, in front of his house, without the aid of a ball or bat. The end of a corn cob and the slat from a wooden orange crate became the early baseball tools of his trade. As an eighth grader, Mason played his first organized game as a member of the Marshall Blue Sox, the local town team. In 1951, after completing high school, he left Marshall and headed to Kansas City and was offered a tryout for the Kansas City Monarchs. The club was managed by the legendary John Buck O'Neill. Mason impressed O'Neill and made the Monarchs roster that season. He drew the Monarchs' opening day assignment to start the 1952 season and hurled 16 amazing innings in defeating the Philadelphia Stars 3-2. That would be his first and last game of the season after being drafted into the United States Marine Corps. Mason rejoined the Monarchs after fulfilling his military duty in 1954 and posted a record 13-6, including a no-hitter against the Indianapolis Clowns. His impressive comeback earned him an invitation to the 54 East-West All-Star Game. At the end of the 54 season, his contract was sold to the Philadelphia Phillies. In 1955 and 56, Mason broke barriers by becoming the first black to play for the Schenectady Blue Jays, a Phillies farm team. His first year, he compiled a 12-4 record with the Jays. He followed that with a 14-7 record the next season and led the league with 7 shutouts and was second in the league with 176 strikeouts. In 1957-58, he was a teammate of Satchel Paige as a member of the Miami Marlins and was 7-2 that year. After spending two seasons with the Buffalo Bisons, Mason joined the Phillies in 1960 and played 62 season before retiring from baseball. He was called to the ministry in 1985, and he has served 10 years as associate pastor at St. James United Methodist Church in Kansas City. Mason today travels the country sharing the story of the Negro Baseball Leagues and is an ambassador promoting the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City, and the world's only museum dedicated to preserving that story. This is an incredible young man who's got a lot of fire in the belt, and I hope you'll help me welcome the Reverend Henry Bo Mason, better known as Pistol.
Thank you. Thank you. For a while, before he called my name, I didn't realize who he was talking about. I am happy and proud that this organization brought me to Boston to speak on the history of the Negro Baseball League. I was here maybe in August or July. I do so much that I'm getting old too, that I was here with an exhibit from the Negro Baseball Museum at the Richard Lewis Center, and some more things, and I was guest of the Boston Red Sox, and I had a good time. And I hope after I leave today that if the price is right, somebody else will bring me back into the Boston area. I want to talk to you a little bit about the history of the Negro Baseball Museum, but first, you know, I feel like the kid I was training with the Kansas City Monarchs in Galveston, Texas. You know, that's not too far from Houston. We stayed in Houston, but we trained in Galveston. So this kid could really hit. So Buck O'Neill said, you know, I had a pretty good fastball, and he said, hey, I want you to pitch this kid in batting practice today. He said, show him your good curveball and your good fastball. I said, okay. And everything that I threw up there, he hit it up against the wall out there. So Buck said, I'm going to take him with me. I said, well, that's fine. So after we broke camp in Galveston, we would travel, you know, we'd play in every little cow pasture that it was, that some of them had candles for lights and stuff like that. But when we arrived in Detroit on that Sunday, we always played in a big league ballpark on Sunday if we were not in Kansas City. And this ballpark was so big and it was so beautiful, and this kid, he was like me, probably the first time that that he had left his mama's side. So when we got to Detroit and everybody dressed, and we came out on in the dugout, and he was looking at Detroit, and he was looking all around, you know, a big ballpark. And Buck O'Neill came out, and he said, say, Buck. Buck said, yeah. He said, where is left field? I never played in this park before. I've been to Boston before, but I haven't been here before. So let me tell you just a little bit about the Negro Baseball League. I want to tell you a little bit about the history, then I'm going to bring you back to when the league was organized. The baseball of the Negro League and of black teams before the era of league play was neglected in its time by the greatest society and has been largely forgotten ever since. Organized baseball has taken credit for a pioneering role in the modern civil rights movement. And indeed, it did provide us with such admirable heroes and role models as Jackie Robinson, Monty Irvin, and Larry Doby, and others who followed them. But organized baseball was white baseball until 1946. Every once in a while, not real often, but every once in a while, a light-skinned Cuban or an Indian would skip through the cracks. And by a gentleman's agreement, would be allowed to play with a white team. But the great black baseball players whose prime became before World War II was consigned to segregated play. Their skills, their status, their stories, and their personalities, unknown even to the most dedicated baseball fan and to the public and to historians. But prior to the 1970 release of Only the Ball Was White by Robert Peterson, baseball historians knew little about the subject, and there was no recognition of the Black League within the mainstream story of our national pastime. Now, the first sustaining Negro Baseball League operated in 1920. It was a man named Andrew Rube Foster who owned a black baseball team, the Chicago American Giants. He was a talented player, a good businessman, a good manager. So he said, we ought to have leagues ourselves within the black baseball community. Well, he came to Kansas City, and he brought all of the other owners. Now, all of these other ball players was playing independent. They would pick up a team here in Boston, and they would travel with that team for about a month, and they would pick up another one, but no league. No league. They were barnstorming. Barnstorming, trying to make a living playing baseball. So it came about as a culmination of years and determined effort by Andrew Rube Foster to organize the best of then independent black teams into a structure similar to that of white baseball, American, and National League. Now, this all took place in the city of Kansas City at a YMCA right on 19th Street. That's where he called all of these people in, all of these owners of these baseball teams, and they started the Negro National League. Black and white baseball had become an entrenched reality as a result of racial intolerance and misunderstanding that ran wild throughout all levels of American society following the Civil War into the 20th century. By 1920, Rube had displayed exceptional baseball talent, and he came to Kansas City, and the owner of the Chicago Giants, the Cuban Stars, the Detroit Stars, Indianapolis ABCs and Kansas City Monarchs, the St. Louis Giants, and the Dayton Marcos joined together to start and organize the first Negro Baseball League. Now, this league operated from 1920 to 1931 and extended into the Deep South when the Birmingham Black Barons and the Memphis Red Sox joined the circuit to the Negro National League. Now, during this time of the Negro National League, they wanted an all-star game, too, just like the American League and the National League. So they started an all-star game. And it was always played in Comiskey Park, Big League Ballpark, Comiskey Park in August annually. And this gave the stars of the Negro League a chance to show what they could do. And you know what? You know what? They played at Comiskey Park. And this all-star game drew more than 50,000 people into the ballpark. Big league ball clubs. Big league ball clubs. I can remember we were playing at Yankee Stadium, playing the Indianapolis Clowns. We had 35,000 people in the ballpark to watch black ball players. And over at Ebbets Field in Brooklyn, a big league ball club, a major league ball club, only had 15,000. Why? Because people wanted to see a different brand of baseball. You see, we played exciting baseball, as I called it. Exciting. We would steal second base, double steal, drag bunt, steal home. And Branch Rickey noticed this. He noticed it. And it was an economic movement on Branch Rickey's part to sign Jackie Robinson so he could get some of that kind of action in Ebbets Field. And when he signed Jackie Robinson, and Jackie was stealing everything but the home plate, the stands start filling up again. Started filling up again. And you know one thing? That started the decline. Right at that moment, that started the decline of the Negro Baseball League. Well, after Jackie signed, there was Larry Doby right behind him. There was Monty Irvin, went to the Giants. And then they just started buying up all the ball players in the Negro League. Why? Because it was some of the best baseball players in the United States. That's why. Well, a lot of people, when I'm doing things like I'm doing now, they would ask me, say, well, how did you travel? Did you fly? Hell, you crazy. Do we fly? No, we travel by bus. We travel by bus every place that we went. And then they ask you, well, where did you stay? Well, I can tell you where we stayed. We stayed in some of the best hotels in the United States that just happened to be black. Well, they say, well, you know, you couldn't go to restaurants. Hey, we ate in some of the best restaurants in the United States. They just happened to be black. Don't you know that Negro baseball per capita was the third largest business, black business, in the United States? The insurance companies was once. Madam C.J. Was first. Madam C.J. Walker was second, and Negro baseball was third. I know you didn't know that, because you don't know too much about the Negro League baseball. Nobody does. Nobody does until things like this happen. And we'd like for you to go out and tell other people about some of the greatest baseball players that ever, I'm not saying the best, I'm saying some of the greatest baseball players in the world played in the Negro League. Willie Mays, Birmingham Black Barons, Hank Aaron, my minutes, and also Willie Mays. I just hated to see him come to the plate when I was pitching for the Phillies. I just hated it. Hank Aaron, Indianapolis Clowns, all are products of black baseball. Let me tell you what happened. I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself, but it's on my mind right now. I got to tell you what happened. In 1955, when I left the Kansas City Monarchs, that league existed only 4 more years. Why? Because they were buying all the black baseball players and sending them to minor leagues, trying to shape them up for the major league. That's why I say that it was some of the best baseball players in the world that came out of the Negro League. You know, my experience in the Negro League was a good experience. I only made $250 a month. Boy, that was a lot of money for a kid that acted a fool and quit college. But that was a lot of money. You could buy a suit, tailor-made, $75. You could buy one of the best KC strips for 65 or 75 cents. You could go to the show for 15 cents and have another dime for popcorn. It was some of the best days of my life in the Negro League. And even after I left the Negro League, I only made $300 a month. I was playing organized baseball and had a major league contract. Made $300 a month with the Schenectady Blue Jays. $300. Stayed there for 2 years. I don't think it would have made any difference if I had a 100 games. You still wouldn't have got but $300 that next year. But you didn't fight City Hall. You had your foot in the door. So keep it in there. I tell you, when I played Major League Baseball, how much do you think I made a year? $6,000. I must have told somebody that. $6,000. A major league contract, $6,000. And I thought I would have got more money going to Schenectady in the Eastern League because I was the first black baseball player to ever play in Schenectady. They didn't care. I was the first black pitcher to ever pitch for the Philadelphia Phillies. And I said, well, that ought to be worth $2,000 more, but it wasn't. John Kennedy was the first black baseball player to ever play for the Phillies, but I was the first black pitcher and the second black player to pay for the Phillies. But, you know, I wouldn't trade it for nothing in the world. Money didn't mean too much to me then. I wish I had got a little bit what the boys are getting now, but, you know, I wouldn't have to travel so much. But black baseball for the black player was the name of the game then. You know, you could go dressed up every day. You could eat in the best hotel in the world. You could sleep in the best hotels. What else? What else was, that was good for me. You know, I could travel all over the United States because we did travel all over the United States. playing baseball. Indianapolis Clowns, pick them up for a month. Then you'd go down to Birmingham and pick up the Birmingham Black Barons. Then you would go someplace else and pick up another team. Doing something that you really love to do, playing baseball. You see, the signs now said they played for the love of the game. You had to because you didn't make much money. I used to like to go down into the Caribbean in the wintertime to play. I played for Venezuela, Puerto Rico, scared to go to Havana at that time, but Santurce, Dominican Republic, all down in there. But Venezuela paid the most money. They paid something like $20,000 for a season. You only played 3 games a week. That was the life. $20,000 in my pocket was just like a donkey in a tin stable. I had plenty of money to take care of my family and to give my parents money. I had plenty of money. But today, it doesn't seem to be enough money to go around for baseball players. I just wish it had happened back in my day. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about the East-West game. The East-West game was played in Chicago at Comiskey Park. And most of the big league scouts would be at Comiskey Park when the All-Star game came. And every now and then you would miss a player here and there because Big League done grabbed him up. Big League had grabbed him up. And I was just hoping. In 1954, I did go to the All-Star game, the East-West All-Star game. And you know what? 55, Pistol Mason was missing. Pistol Mason was missing because the Phillies had grabbed him up. The baseball of the Negro League and the black teams should be in every museum there is. If you ever come to Kansas City, and go to the museum, you have Don Motley or Kenya to call me, and I'm going to give you a free escort so I can tell you what is really happening. What is really happening in that museum? You need to know. You really need to know. Well, in 1920, when Rube Foster had displayed all of this talent about black baseball and all of the black baseball players in 1950 was leaving, it hurt the community, all black communities, because, let me tell you, black baseball spent a lot of money in black communities. You know one thing, on Sunday, when we were in town in Kansas City, worship services in black churches started at 9 o'clock so that they could get out in time to get to the ball game at 1. There was a little film that I was going to bring with me, but they didn't have the equipment. I just wish you could see. I wish you could see. You know, in 1954 in Kansas City, when I pitched opening day, there was 15,036 fans at Blue Stadium. in St. Louis, the Cardinals was playing Cincinnati, and there was 2,000 people there. What did people want to see? They wanted to see exciting baseball. Now, I must tell you this, too. How many of you have watched the Bingo Long story and the soul of the game? That's a disgrace to the Negro League. Nothing like that ever happened in the Negro League. The Negro League should have sued HBO for putting the soul of the game, that kind of a thing. That was disgraceful. So don't believe that kind of stuff. Come to Kansas City. I want you to come to Kansas City so I can take you and show you all the films that's in Kansas City, plus all of the memorabilia and everything that's in the museum. And I don't think that you would ever forget what you... Every black baseball player that played in the Negro League that didn't go to the major league, that was inducted into the Hall of Fame, is right there in statue. Bronze statue on a baseball field in that museum. So you just got to come to see it. You just got to come to see it. And I'll even give you free admission. It only costs, I think, $5 to go through. I'll have Motley and I'll have the museum say, no, just let them go. Just let them go free, just so that you can see what Negro baseball did in the United States after the racial ban was dropped. Now I'm going to stop there. And...
Is it on now? Can you hear? Okay, great. I'll repeat myself quickly. I'm Pat Zirke from Cambridge Forum, and we're recording your questions as well as Reverend Mason's answers. And I know there are a lot of you who are far from the microphone. If you can't get down to the microphone to ask your question, I will repeat it so that your question as well as his answer are recorded for the radio broadcast. And I would like to ask the first question. You alluded to it in your remarks. When Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, how did the players in the Negro League at the time feel about that? We've heard a little bit about how white baseball players reacted to Jackie Robinson joining the Dodgers, but how did his old teammates feel?
I wasn't there, but Buck O'Neill was there, and he said that all of the team was very, very proud of Jackie. And he also said that gave every other black baseball player on the Kansas City Monarchs an incentive to play harder, because they knew that one day, maybe, if they could produce enough, that they would be in the major league.
So he didn't really foresee the end of the Negro League, or was he looking to end the Negro League? Did this surprise people?
I think that it did surprise some people. At that time, they wasn't looking at the league, they were looking at Jackie, and we thought that maybe the Negro League would probably be in existence today, because there were other kids that could play baseball. And if they did deplete the league, other people would come to become stars. Younger people would become stars in the Negro League.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yes. I just stated that...
Excuse me. Could I just say the question for mm-hmm. the tape? Has there been any recognition of Cooperstown of the Negro League?
Oh, yes. There are a lot of baseball players that never played in the major league or minor league, that played only in the Negro League, that has been inducted into the Hall of Fame. The other day, Hilton Smith is going to be inducted in August. I called his son, Mickey Smith. We play golf together when we have time, and congratulated him on his father's into the Hall of Fame. And there's going to be more. Not me, but there's going to be a lot more.
Hi, it's a pleasure to hear you speak and to meet you. And there's a number of questions that I could ask, but this one I would like to ask is that you really paint quite a different picture to me anyway, in the way that you describe your love of the game, the financial money that you made that you could supply to yourself and your family. You got to see the world. You ate in nice restaurants and stayed in beautiful hotels. But oftentimes I get a different picture that, I don't know, the media paints about the Negro League and the white community and that racial relationship. I don't know, maybe you could explain a little bit more or help me to understand a little better.
I don't think that the white sports writers knew anything to write about the Negro League. All the coverage that we received was from black newspapers, and they didn't have any of the road games. They had all of the home games. So I don't think that they really knew. I'd say, you know, even historians, baseball historians, didn't know anything about the Negro League until the book came out by Robert Peterson, Only the Ball Was White, in 1970. And then there's a group of writers called the Sabres. They started researching all of this kind of thing. And now it's coming to the public eye what black baseball players did. There are some real good records. And you might not want to buy the book, but if you see a book of... by Larry Lester. He's a Sabre writer, and he lives in Kansas City, and he's a good friend of mine. Buy that book, and you will see the record, my record, everybody's record that played in the Black League, in the Negro League.
Hi. Considering how great you folks were in playing the game, have they ever officially changed the statistics to give you representation before Jackie Robinson's time? Say, for instance, I mean, I've always heard that Satchel Paige was such a great baseball player, in some ways better than even Babe Ruth. But at the same time, it's sort of like you were sort of like made invisible, you know, as far as getting that recognition of your
your superiority in this whole entire thing. So I just wondered whether or not that had ever been officially recognized by the baseball people.
Satchel Paige was one of the greatest pitchers that I've ever seen pitch. I had the privilege of playing with Satchel in Miami with the Miami Marlins. Bill Vecht owned the ball club, and the Phillies had a working agreement with the Miami Marlins to send players down there that had the potential. That was a AAA farm club in the International League that had AAA was next to the Major League that had the potential of being Major League ball players. When Satchel was really in his prime, I don't think, now some of the Major League white teams knew about Satchel because they barnstormed with him. You know, they would have a white all-star, Major League all-star team, and they would have an all-star team from the Negro League. And the Negro League players won 60% of the games. Now, that's on record. That's on record. But when Satchel was really in his prime, no.
Are you happy with the Baseball Hall of Fame? I mean, are you satisfied with what they have there?
Yes.
Yeah.
You mean in Cooperstown?
Yeah.
I am now, yes, because there's a lot of black baseball players that didn't get the recognition that's getting it now.
Okay, because Ed Stack is a good friend of mine.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, yeah,
all right.
Yeah, I've known him for years, so I'm really happy to hear from somebody else that he's doing a good job.
Yes, yes he is.
Reverend, my name is Anthony Guerrero, and I teach a course at Salem State College called A Social History of Baseball. Mm-hmm. And what we're doing is paralleling the baseball, the rise of professional baseball in American history. We just completed a section on Negro League baseball talking about Cool Papa Bell, Pop Lloyd, Charlie Tuckahoma Grant. And I have two questions for you.
Okay.
Number one,
okay,
how old was Satchel Paige when he broke in with the Cleveland Indians in 1948?
If I knew that, you know, when I was playing with Satchel at Miami, a reporter said, "You're a good friend of Satchel's." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I will give you $500 if you find out the exact age Satchel is." And I was still broke. I don't think anybody really knew. Now, some people say that he was 42 when he went to the Cleveland Indians. But I don't think anybody. I talk with Satchel a lot, and he told me a lot about his life. But he never did tell me his real age.
When I was a student at UMass, I did my master's thesis on Jackie Robinson and studied for 15 months racial integration, met with Rachel Robinson, who's a wonderful person. In my research, I came across an interesting question, which I'd like to pose to you. Was Jackie Robinson the right person to cross the color barrier? Some say that it should have been Monty Irvin. When I was a student at UMass, I did my master's thesis on Jackie Robinson and studied for 15 months racial integration, met with Rachel Robinson, who's a wonderful person. In my research, I came across an interesting question, which I'd like to pose to you. Was Jackie Robinson the right person to cross the color barrier? Some say that it should have been Monty Irvin. Some believe it should have been Josh Gibson.
No. Jackie was the right person at the right time. Those other guys could not have withheld their tempers. And if Jackie had a messed up, there wouldn't be a black baseball player right now in the major league. See, Jackie had went to UCLA. Jackie had a good education and a good head. Let me tell you a little story about Jackie. A buck told me that they were traveling down south someplace, and they pulled into a filling station, and they had two 50-gallon tanks on the bus. So Jackie got out and started going to the bathroom, and the guy said he had started filling the tank. And the attendant said, hey, where are you going? He said, I'm going to the bathroom. He said, you can't go and use that bathroom. He said, why? He said, because you black. He said, pull the pump, pull the nozzle out of the tank. And he said, what do you mean? He said, we're not going to buy any gas here. And he says, he looked around and to see if anybody, he said, well, go ahead this time, but next time you can't go. So, see, Jackie was smart. Jackie was real smart. Jackie, who they really thought was going, Jackie might not have been the best ball player, but he was the best man at that time. Connie Johnson, who was a pitcher, they thought he would be the first that would go in, but Connie didn't have as much intellect as a Jackie. Jackie was the right person at that time.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hi, Mr. Mason. Who gave you your nickname Pistol, and is it for your fastball or is it for something else?
I would prefer not to say. It wasn't for the fastball, although I could throw about 95 miles an hour. Wait till you have Buck down here sometime and ask him.
Okay, one more question. When 50,000 people showed up to see two black teams playing an all-star game, aside from Major League scouts and possibly owners, was there any white fan base there?
Yes, yes. Yeah, there were white fans at all of our games. And we didn't segregate the seats. You know, we let everybody sit together.
Reverend, I'd just like to ask you, did you ever play against Sam Jethro?
Sammy Jethro?
Right.
Yes, sir. I played against Sammy Jethro. I was with the Miami Marlins, and Sammy Jethro was with the Toronto Maple Leafs in the International League.
Right. But he was the first black ball player for the Boston Braves, and he was in the early 50s. The Boston Braves, and he played a few years. But for the Red Sox, who are very well integrated today, Pumpsy Green was the first ball player.
Pumpsy Green was at Albany in 1956 when I was at Schenectady Blue Jays. Boston was one of the last teams.
I think it was I just wanted to mention that because I remember saying
I know Pumpsy Green and Earl Wilson. Remember the pitcher, Earl Wilson? Yeah, I played against those guys in the Eastern League.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Mr. Mason, very interesting. I had another question, but when I came up here, I heard so much about Satchel Paige. I want to give you a little information about Satchel Paige.
Okay.
They put him in the outfield one time, and he waved to the manager. He says, come on out. And he says, what's the problem? He says, there's a snake in the grass.
I don't know anything about that. That was probably before my time. I first met Satchel in 1957 in Miami. That's where I played with Satchel. I played 1 year with Satchel at Miami with the Miami Marlins. Then the Phillies changed franchises, and we moved to Buffalo, New York. So that's where the Phillies were sending their AAA farm players down at Buffalo.
And also, Satchel Paige, up until Raleigh Fingers went in the Hall of Fame, those two are the only two pitchers in the Hall of Fame with a lifetime losing record.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
They're both relievers.
Yes, that's pretty good.
And the third question is, did Josh Gibson ever catch you?
No, that was before my time.
Before your time.
No, that was before my time. I went into the league in 1951. I was only about 20, almost 21, when I went into the league.
Instead of Josh Gibson had come up to the majors, Roy Campanella would have been the second string.
That's right. That's what they tell me. So he must have been pretty good, because Campanella was a good catcher himself.
I'm the best.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
Hi, I used to play baseball also, and I played in the minor league, and I was also on the Phillies. Unfortunately, I was
a Philly?
The Phillies.
Oh, okay, all right.
So I was the only girl on my team, and unfortunately, I was treated differently than my fellow teammates, and I was going to ask if that ever happened to you.
Well, there were three girls in the Negro League. Tony Stone, Connie Morgan, and it's one in Washington now. I saw her maybe a month ago. Peanuts. And Peanuts was here with me in July or August. But, no, we didn't treat them any differently. No, we sure didn't.
Did you ever give up any home runs to Hank Aaron?
Well, let me tell you, no. He didn't break the record with any home runs that he hit off of me. But let me say this. We were playing Milwaukee in Philadelphia one Saturday afternoon. And Bobby Del Greco, he was playing outfield. Bobby Del Greco, he was a center fielder. And Bobby Del Greco and myself was traded from the Phillies to the Kansas City A's in 1960. And Bobby went to Kansas City, and I went to Honolulu in the Pacific Coast League. In Philadelphia, in Connie Mack Stadium, it was built like this. And center field was about 500 feet, or maybe 550 feet. And I threw Hank Aaron a fastball like I've never thrown before. On the outside corner, I had two strikes on him, on the outside corner of the plate. And Bobby Del Greco had to go back to the wall and jump up and catch the ball. He hit it that far. It should have went out. No, he never did hit a home run off of me. But that was close. And that's authentic. That's the truth. Let me tell you about, while he's getting his question ready, my debut in the Major League. We were playing at Connie Mack Stadium, and we were playing San Francisco Giants, and they were killing us. I think it was about 15-1 or 2 or something like that. And Eddie Sawyer, the manager for the Phillies, he called down and said, "Hey, get Mason ready." So I got ready, and when I walked in, the bases were loaded. Bases loaded. And I don't know whether you remember Jimmy Coker or not. We came up through the ranks together. He was a catcher. So he ran out to the mound. He said, "Hey, Hank." He said, "Same as AAA, same as AAA." I said, "Okay." I had just had a good year with the Buffalo Bisons. We had won the International League Championship. I think I was 12-3 that year with about 19 or 20 saves. Man, I was ready. So I ran out there. I got to the mound, and I took a few tosses. And then who do you think was the next hitter? Willie Mays. So I just stood there like this. So Jimmy Coker ran back out and said, "What's the matter, Hank?" I said, "Nothing, man." He said, "Yeah, it is." He said, "Oh, that's just Willie Mays." He said, "Come on." He said, "You know the stats on him." I said, "Yeah." I said, "Keep the ball in on him with everything you got." "Yeah, good." I said, "That's what we'll do." First two strikes, I went in on him, you know, with some smoke. Good stuff. Strike two, no balls. And I said, "I got him now. I got him now." So I said, "I'm going to throw him a curveball that's going to miss the plate about that far. Then I'm going to come back. I'm setting him up for that fastball again on the inside." Jimmy Coker put down. Then Jimmy said, "Time." Came out to the mound. He said, "Hey, if you're going to waste a pitch, waste one with a fastball inside." I said, "No, I'm going to set him up." He said, "Okay." Went back, and I threw him one of the best breaking curveballs that goes down, missed the plate this far. He hit that ball off of that right field. He hit the ball off of the right field fence for a triple. And that was 3 more runs, 18-0 then. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Did you ever strike out, Hank Aaron?
Did I ever strike out?
Hank Aaron.
Hank, no. Mm-mm. No. No, I never struck out Hank Aaron. No.
I have 3 questions. The first one is, did you ever play with Jackie Robinson or against him?
No. No, Jackie was before my time, too. I met Jackie Robinson when I was playing for the Buffalo Bisons, and he came down to the clubhouse. I pitched that night, and he said, "I guarantee you, you're going to be in the major league before the year's over with," and I was. That's the only time I met him. I've met his wife and his daughter in the latter years, but no.
Was Cool Papa Bell in the major leagues ever, or why not? He wasn't.
What did he say? Wants to know, was Cool Papa Bell ever in the major leagues?
Cool Papa Bell was one, but he's in the Hall of Fame. He's in the Hall of Fame. He never made the major league, but he's in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown.
Did you ever pitch a perfect game, or how many perfect games?
A perfect game? No. I tell you, I have pitched where I just faced 29 men, but that's not perfect.
I was wondering if you had played with, I believe he was with Kansas City, Ernie Banks.
Ernie Banks. Ernie Banks left the year before I started playing with Kansas City.
Mm-hmm. And also in the Negro Hall of Fame, are there players like Henry Aaron, Ernie Banks, who played a little bit in the Negro Leagues and went on to the majors, or is it reserved for players who exclusively played in the Negro Leagues?
I don't understand your question.
Within the Hall of Fame, is a player like Henry Aaron in the Negro League Hall of Fame, or would you have had to play your entire career in the Negro League to be in the Hall of Fame?
No. All of them are together. Uh-huh. All of them are together.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for a really exciting presentation.
Thank you.
And I'm originally from Brooklyn, and Jackie Robinson was my idol.
In fact,
I wrote a letter to his wife, Rachel, when he died, unfortunately, at a very young age. You know, since you would like to make this more available to everyone, had you ever thought of contacting Ken Burns? Ken Burns. Have him do for the Black League.
Oh, I did some work with Ken Burns in Kansas City.
But I'm thinking about actually having him do a documentary on the Black Baseball League.
I don't want to do.
In other words, having him do a documentary the way he did a documentary on baseball in general, the White League.
I think, maybe a couple of years ago that we all. I think he's working on that.
Is that right? He's right over here in Walpole, New Hampshire. He's not very far away.
Okay,
I would suggest to contact him. He's a very nice guy. I might be able to save a trip to Kansas City.
Okay, all right, okay.
Thank you.
I have like 3 questions.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Who's the hardest team to play?
Pardon?
When you were in the Negro Leagues, what was the toughest team you were put up against or something?
All of them were tough. But I think maybe the Indianapolis Clowns next to Kansas City, they had the best baseball players. You know, the Kansas City Monarchs, they sent more baseball players to the major league than any other Negro team in the league. I think maybe it was about 36 or 37. It might be, if my memory serves me right, it's about 36 or 37 baseball players.
And did you strike anyone out famous in the major leagues or the Negro leagues?
Did I strike anybody out?
Famous people.
Famous? Well, some of them was famous, so let me think now. Yeah, I did strike out quite a few guys in the major league.
Did...
I'm just curious about the kind of reception you received when he went to play for Schenectady. When Jackie came up to the major leagues, you know, there were potential boycotts. Some of the teams wanted to boycott playing against him, and there were racial incidents. By the time you played at Schenectady, was that sort of passé, or did you have any particular issues come up? I was just wondering.
I think some of that stuff is still around today, and it certainly was when I first went to Schenectady. You know, I think that whenever a black baseball player would join a team, somebody knew that if he was good enough to get there, somebody else was going to lose their job. You know, like I went to Schenectady on a Sunday, and a white boy left on a Monday, because when I got to Schenectady, I guess they said, well, I'm going to see what he can do today, and I pitched 6 innings of shutout ball in Schenectady my first time there. And, you know, it was still, and it still is some racial discrimination, but I was called a lot of names and everything like that, and some of my teammates didn't like me, but I said, well, I made it thus far. I'm not going to let my mouth interrupt what I have to do, but I'm going to let my ability do the talking. And after that first season, almost the end of the season, everybody was, everybody was friendly on the team. Well, now it wasn't too many, maybe 5 or 6 that didn't like black folk. But by the time I finished that season, almost that season, I was invited to a lot of stores and restaurants and things like that, making a little extra money signing autographs. So I had to be cool. I was the first black there, and I didn't want to ruin it for other blacks.
Okay, good. Thank you.
How many strikeouts did you have in your whole career?
In my whole career? Oh, gosh, I wish I had the book. I know my ERA was 3.24, but I think maybe it was, oh, I don't know, 600 or 700, somewhere around in there.
Did you ever win the Cy Young Award?
Oh, boy. Not yet.
Mr. Mason, thank you. What kind of reception did you get in Philadelphia when you came up?
Philadelphia? Let me see. Oh, Philadelphia. It wasn't too bad. Those guys were a little bit, see, they knew where they were. And they knew where they were going to stay. You take guys like Robin Roberts, one of the best friends that I ever had. Kurt Simmons, one of the best friends I ever had. Harry Anderson, Wally Pose. Now, Richie Ashburn and I didn't get along very well, but it wasn't anything bad. You know, he was just that kind of a guy. Andy Simonac, he managed me down at Williamsport once. I was down there for about 2 weeks. It was fine in Philadelphia. It was fine. The only place that I was fortunate that I didn't have to play in but one southern town in my whole baseball career. When I was playing with Schenectady, all of them was out east. All of the towns were out east. When I played with Miami, we had one town beside Miami, and I stayed at my own house in Miami. Was Richmond, Virginia. It was Richmond, Virginia, where we had to stay in a different hotel. But all the rest of the time, I stayed where everybody else stayed. I ate where everybody else ate. And in spring training, we had been over to, I was with the Phillies, and we had been someplace to play a spring training game. And on the way back, we were on the bus. And I'm going to tell you how the guys were in Philadelphia. And we stopped at this restaurant. And we all went in, and I sat down with Harry Anderson and a couple of the guys. And the manager came over and told Charlie Meister, he was the general, he was the traveling secretary, that I couldn't eat in there. And he said, well, if he don't eat, none of us will eat. And it was about 50 ball players. You can carry all those ball players, and he never would see 50 people in there that they're all going to eat steak, because if it was free, all the ball players were going to eat steak. So he said, well, yeah, he's all right. He can stay. So
Question. Back in the 40s, were there any African-American businessmen, administrators who ran the league who didn't want their players to go up to the major leagues because they might have thought it would mean the eventual demise?
I don't think so, because at that time, if you could sell a player to the major league, that was just some more money coming in for the club to operate. You know, they had a hard time there for a while, even keeping players, and I should have told you that. Some of the teams folded. They folded because they didn't have enough money to keep it going.
I have two questions. One is, who's the most memorable player you ever pitched against?
Most memorable player? I'd say Stan Musial.
And two, what's the most memorable game you ever played in?
I would say not the no-hitter that I pitched, but the one-hitter that I pitched against the Havana Sugar Kings in the International League.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mason. I quickly want to touch on pensions for Negro League players. I understand that the Negro League Baseball Players Association is giving small pensions to some Negro Leaguers, but to the best of my knowledge, after 1948, they don't consider you as a Negro Leaguer.
Well, that's the way that they voted in Atlanta when we were down there, that any player after 1948 was would not be entitled to any of the pension. Now, there's about 250, well, maybe not that many. Now, I'd say 225 or 210 black baseball players today, that most of them played after 48. And these other guys that played below before 48, they are the ones that are getting the pension.
And the reason that you guys aren't getting the pension, supposedly, is that there was a decline and there was no talent. Yet there was an awful lot of talent in the early 50s taken from the Negro Leagues.
Well, let me tell you one thing, and I tell everybody this. You look at the statistics, and that's when most of the major league was buying ball players from the black league from the 50s on up. That's why they had to dismantle, because they couldn't put enough players on the field. They could not put enough, but I don't know why it's just from 48 down. Maybe it is because of the money that they had. That, see, they only get this pension every quarter. I think it's every quarter. So when they get it every quarter, there's a reasonable amount of money. Now, if they had to put all 250 ball players at that time, wouldn't anybody be getting anything anyway? So maybe that's why they did. I'm not sure.
Just one more quick question. Did Buck O'Neill call you Booger?
Does Buck O'Neill call me?
When you played for Buck O'Neill, did he call you Booger?
He does now. Yeah.
Hi, I have a question regarding, you were talking about the offseason and playing in Venezuela, was it?
Venezuela.
And that you were getting Republic. You were getting paid more in the offseason than during the regular season?
Well, about three times more. About three times more. If you consider me with a major league contract, yeah. About three times more. I made $20,000 when I played winter baseball. I made $6,000 regular season. So it's about three times more.
Was that typical for players at that time, or is it?
That was the minimum for any major league ball player at that time. And you know they wasn't going to give you over the minimum if they didn't have to.
Okay, this is going to be our last question, so it's very important.
No, I didn't strike out Willie Mays.
Did you ever, when you played on the team with Satchel Paige, was it fun playing on the same on his team?
It did what now?
Was it fun
to play with Satchel Paige?
Yeah, it was fun. See, when I was with the Marlins, I was making about $550 a month, AAA baseball. So Satchel, I don't know what he was making. I know he was making 10 times $550 a month.